Hi, I'm Pete Docter, the director of Monsters Incorporated. Welcome to the commentary on the DVD.
Hi, I'm Andrew Stanton, and I'm screenwriter and co-executive producer.
Hi, I'm John Lasseter. I'm executive producer.
And I'm Lee Unkrich, co-director of Monsters, Inc. And welcome.
Even though Monsters Incorporated is Pixar's fourth film, its origins start back even before our first film, Toy Story. Toy Story was the first computer animated feature film and Pixar's first feature. And Andrew and Pete and I, along with Joe Ramp, developed the story of that.
So one of the things I loved about working on Toy Story was how many friends came up to me and said, oh, I totally believed that my toys came to life when I wasn't in the room. And I was looking around for other things like that that we all experienced as a kid, that the sort of a shared experience. So I knew that monsters lived in my closet and were coming out to scare me at night. So I figured a lot of other people felt that way too.
The purpose of the title sequence here is basically to set the tone of the film. Without it, we actually had an earlier version where we start right in on the kid asleep in bed, and it becomes a much more spooky, dark, kind of scary tone that we're laying down. With the title sequence, we're hoping to tell people this is going to be fun, it's going to be colorful and upbeat. Jeefy Bodo had designed it and also animated it along with Patrick Seymour.
What we always try to look for at Pixar is an idea, a story, or subject matter that really connects with the audience, that the audience can relate to. We kind of call it our foundation with the audience, something that they go, yeah, I know that, or that happened to me as a kid. But then we show it to them in a way that they've never thought of before.
Growing up, I had this idea that the way animated films were made was that one night Walt would just sit upright in bed and say, Dumbo. And from that point on, it was just a matter of doing what was in his brain. This is not anywhere near the truth. These films really begin with an idea, and then they change and they grow and they evolve into something stronger and better. So in this film, we boarded and reboarded dozens of scenes, you know, dozens of times, as is the case on all our films. But this one sequence was somewhat of an exception. We boarded it early on. Nate Stanton, was one of our top story guys on the show, boarded this. And it was the first in production. It was,
yeah, this is the very first scene that we animated.
Pretty much unchanged. And his boards matched very closely to that.
Although, ironically, while this was the very first scene to go into animation, it was actually the very last scene to pretty much to get completed, because we added the whole idea of the monster freaking out and destroying the room kind of at the 11th hour.
Yeah. Yeah, it was initially that it ended right about here where the monster raises up, the kid screams,
and
the lights
right
on
at this point.
Yeah. And that was it. And what we found was that people were really identifying with the kid. And so we needed something to get back at the monster and turn the tables.
Yeah, and again, it was a way to, like the title sequence, to say, yeah, we just scared you a little bit, but no, this is going to be a really funny movie.
Right, so it really reinforces one of the key concepts that monsters are actually scared of kids. This sequence here was a real bugger. We must have reboarded it like 80 times. We even changed it again after we'd finished animating it.
It was really hard to set up this world without being too expositional. You know, this is a world no one's ever seen before, and we wanted to get across a lot of ideas really, really quickly about the rules of the world, and that the monsters were afraid of kids, and that there's an energy crisis, and we were constantly playing this game of, you know, how much information is too much information, and at the same time we wanted people to know what was going on. Bonnie Hunt plays Fortrant, the red kind of woman behind the console, and she used to actually have a much bigger part in the film, but in the course of developing the story, she ended up getting cut back, unfortunately, because we love working with Bonnie, and she always brings so much to the characters.
Mr. Waternoose!
There's nothing more toxic or deadly than a human child.
We came up with the idea that the reason monsters go in to kids' rooms and scare them is they collect the scream, the kids, you know, when they see a monster, they scream. They collect that, and they refine it into a clean, efficient fuel. It's the fossil fuel of monsters' world.
And that was something that Andrew really brought in your first draft.
That the scream thing just fits so well, and it had such visual potential, and it's fun.
And then we really got to capitalize on the work situation.
Right.
The fact there are these slobbery, snarly beasts that clock in and clock out every day.
I need scarers like James P. Sullivan.
Sully's introduction was another tricky thing that we went over and over on. The original introduction was just him roaring into the camera.
Right, we jumped kind of right into the exercise montage.
And then at the 11th hour, Bob Peterson, our head of story, had this idea for the radio announcer. I think it works really great. You get the reverse of Sully having this big build-up from Waterness. He's confident, tough, and so on. And then he's asleep. Plus you get the mic as a radio announcer, which tells us a lot about his character. Guy who plays jokes, he always has something to say, and it also gave Billy Crystal a chance to play around a little bit.
Right.
Here with the exercise, we needed something to pick up the pace after all that exposition and the sleeping, as well as to tell us about Sully and Mike as characters, who they are. Besides being roommates and total scare fanatics, you know, that's just, this is the first thing they do in the morning is they hop into exercise.
This is also our first glimpse at the really cool architecture that was created for the film, the design of the film.
The commercial coming up here is a great way to sell even more exposition that we needed to tell the audience about, hopefully in a way that makes them laugh and be entertained as well.
Try to make it like a kind of a cheesy infomercial.
Yeah. Yeah, we patterned it on all those wonderfully hokey power and energy commercials that you see. And we really approached it as though we were selling a real company. A lot of us did commercials professionally at Pixar before we started on features. So we had some experience there.
So we try to make this as kind of awkwardly produced as possible.
We found this great announcer, Jim Thornton, who we felt had this great sort of almost a 50s or retro quality to his voice and real authentic. That image in the corner there of the kid being scared is an image that we as animators see on our screens.
It's kind of like what the unrendered animation looks like when it doesn't have any lighting or shaders or anything on it.
Yeah. So as we started to develop the story and the characters, for Sullivan we needed someone with great strength and somebody who could be like the star quarterback, but also a sensitivity and warmth to him. And as we hit on John Goodman, that was just seemed perfect. He has this real gruffness to his voice and a strength. For Mike, Billy Crystal was, again, as we thought of him, was perfect. He's got this real upbeat, bubbly, sort of a Burgess Meredith type character to.
Right, and we knew we'd get a ton out of him in terms of improvisation, which is always great in animation. Since we do the voices before the animation, we can just let the actors cut loose and come up with great stuff, and that always just really livens up in the animation and makes for some great performance.
We actually approached Billy to do the voice of Buzz Lightyear in Toy Story way back when, and he turned us down. And then we went on to hire Tim Allen, who did an amazing job. But Billy was telling us he was kicking himself ever since for turning that down.
The city here, you can see, was really one of the most challenging sets in the film. We wanted it to look really rich and detailed, but we didn't have a whole lot of time, screen time, so we couldn't justify spending tons of time to build it. So
the whole thing ended up getting built really like a Hollywood backlot in terms of, you know, there's not a whole lot of city that was actually built, but we really tried to maximize, you know, the use of it. Tony, the Italian grocer here, we knew we wanted an Italian voice, and we had some actors do kind of a put-on Italian accent, but it just wasn't making us laugh.
So we got one of our technical directors here, Guido Quaroni, who's actually Italian, and he actually did some of the more amazing effects work in the film. Ted's roar here was originally a big loud roar from a famous movie monster whom I won't mention here. We weren't able to get the rights to it, so instead we went the opposite way and put in this chicken. I think it works.
We think it's funny.
Yeah.
It's just kind of bizarre.
As we come into the lobby here, we wanted it to have a grand sort of institutional feel to it. Big tile painting seemed like a logical choice.
Just as a general design philosophy, it's great. I mean, Pete and I are both huge fans of kind of that culture and architecture and the look of the early 1960s, and I think it's really cool that it permeates this film.
So the geeks here, Needleman and Smitty are their names that we've referred to them. They're voiced by Dan Gerson, writer on the show. And he, of course, wrote all their lines, too. It was basically a case of he did the scratch, the temporary dialogue that we just work with. And
yeah, it's becoming a pattern here at Pixar. Like more and more people who just work at Pixar who do the scratch voices end up just making us crack up, and we use them in the film.
Celia here, Harley Jessup, our production designer, came with this idea of using snakes for hair, you know, basically pulling from Medusa. And we experimented with the idea that Mike sees all of her old boyfriends all turned to stone, which, you know, puts the pressure on him rather to behave. But it didn't fit, and it was kind of unappealing for her character.
Jennifer Tilly does Celia's voice, and she's just such a sweetheart and just brings such great character to Celia.
Not. So early on, we had been recording, which is fairly typical, each of the actors on their own, Billy Crystal, John Goodman. And the film really called for them to be best friends since kindergarten, and they just knew each other so well that I had the idea to bring them both in, both the actors at the same time.
To record in a session together in the same room, which wasn't typical.
Right. And that really gave us a lot of spontaneity, and they improv, they just brought everything, the energy level up. It was really great. This is Randall's introduction here. We wanted something that would also introduce his ability to camouflage as well as his character.
He's voiced by Steve Buscemi.
Yeah. Who actually, when we showed him the character design, he said, "Hey, you're typecasting me." He has a somewhat of a physical resemblance.
Well, he has six arms anyway.
Yeah. That should make it even more humiliating when we break the record first.
Ha ha! Do you hear that? It's the winds of change.
I also thought of him as sort of a, you know, one of those guys in junior high that just would push you for no real reason.
Yeah, he was probably a real bully and a jerk in junior high school, and he's just kind of stayed that way.
Yeah. Coming up here on Roz, she's voiced by Bob Peterson, our head of story. And she was actually, originally, she was the orientation manager at Monsters, Inc. She was such a great character that when that part got cut out, we recast her as the dispatch manager.
Sound like a broken record here, but same deal again. We couldn't find anybody who made us laugh as much as Bob. We tried really hard.
Yeah.
And we ended up just pitching Bob up a little bit, and he's Roz.
The scare floor here, day in the life of the scare floor, it's just so cool. I love the way this worked out. Lee worked really closely with David Silverman to board the whole thing, and then with the layout folks to put this really cool montage together.
We just had this idea of the camera constantly moving and making it feel like those great montages from films of the 30s, kind of WPA progress, you know, teamwork, everybody working together, and Randy Newman's great music is really the icing on the cake in the sequence here.
What I love about it is how that it's basically all visual exposition about the operation of the place, but it's so exhilarating to watch, and it gets you really pumped up.
Bob Pauly and Gary Schultz were really the two responsible for designing all these door stations and the mechanics of everything, and they're just such freaks for the details and making sure everything actually could work. You almost feel like you could take their designs and hand them to a company, and they could really build these things.
Bob has, you know, big airplane parts sitting around in his office. He's just a fan of industrial design.
This little bit here, of course, inspired by the classic shot from The Right Stuff with the astronauts walking down the hall.
Which, weirdly enough, you show it to a lot of people, especially young people today, and they say, "Oh, Armageddon!" So one of the problems in this whole set was the idea of the door stations. We wanted to follow the logic that when a monster is in a kid's room, the kid would sit up, and we didn't want him to see back onto the scare floor. So we thought, what if we do it like a voting booth where you have this curtain that pulls around? But then the problem is the audience can't see the coolness of this, you know, from the scare floor looking back into the kids' rooms. So that didn't work. Then we thought, there's actually these weird things in computer graphics. You can have a light that sucks away light. It's like a negative light. So we were playing around with having one of those.
But that ended up looking just kind of bizarre.
Yeah, you couldn't read it. You know, your brain didn't get that. So we ended up just ignoring it, and maybe the kids do see onto the scare floor. I don't know. So the sign wall was really difficult because we had to track it from shot to shot, make sure that it all made sense.
Again, people probably won't even notice or care whether the numbers are correct, but we spent a long time figuring them all out and making sure they were tracking correctly.
So we've worked backwards from the idea that Sully breaks 100,000 this day, and figuring that means he averages about 445.9 scream units per day, the back of the envelope calculation. And this is
just off the top of your head.
This is a particularly good day, so we start Sully at 99,479. You'll notice at the end of the list, at the very bottom, is Gerson, who's named after Dan Gerson, and his at the end of the day, his totals go up one scream unit. Pathetic.
A lot of the kids' screams in this sequence are actually our own kids that we brought in to scream. Probably made their lives to be able to stand there and have their parents actually order them to scream at the top of their lungs. This shot coming up here with the cart was inspired by Terry Gilliam's great film Brazil. We always knew we wanted to find a place to put this shot idea into the sequence.
Here comes Henry Waters again. He was voiced by James Coburn, and he brought this great warmth and vulnerability, really, to the character. I'd always thought of him as a hard-hitting businessman, yeah, you know, and Coburn had this sort of sensitive underbelly that you really feel like the weight of the world, this factory that's not doing so well now, is resting squarely on his shoulders. Feel a little bad for him.
Yeah, he has such a great warmth. You know, like you trust him.
Yeah.
You just trust that voice,
yeah.
Which makes it great later in the film when we turn the tables and reveal that he's not such a great guy. Oh. Well, if this is the first time you're watching the movie, stop it now and turn us off.
Kids these days, they just don't get scared like they used to. What a rip!
This, the idea that the door must be shredded once the kids aren't scared anymore, it was really meant to be a setup for why Sullivan can't see Boo again at the end. And it makes sense, too, that they wouldn't bother keeping these things around if they're no use anymore. Randall's assistant Fungus is voiced by Frank Oz, who's one of my heroes growing up as a performer and now as a director.
And of course, the voice of Miss Piggy and Grover and a million other great characters.
Slumber party! Woo!
Never mind. I love this where he gives him five. And Hand Eye was actually inspired sort of by puppetry. The fact that he's just a hand with eyes on the ends of his fingers. It's just a funny idea. We had some great concept sketches of how he carries things and how does he operate stuff, you know, by using his eyeballs.
One last great Pixar cameo coming up here. George, the orange furry guy who gets abused throughout the film, is voiced by Sam Black, who's one of our programmers here. We just think his voice is incredibly funny.
He came in to read for Scratch dialogue for Mike. You know, Scratch is what we do temporarily while we're building the reels. And I could barely restrain myself from just snickering and laughing through the whole thing.
So we never tried to find anybody else for him. We knew Sam had the part from day one.
Yeah.
This is the birth of the CDA, the Child Detection Agency. Now, after one screening, we were looking at it, and we realized we were just talking about how dangerous kids were, and we needed to show it.
Yeah, and I think we had to turn this around in like a day or something like that, if I remember correctly. And Ted Matthau and Nathan Stanton, me, Bretta, they had to, they boarded up. They came up with this sort of stormtrooper-esque idea, and it just sold like $1 million.
That was amazing.
Just we wanted to show, just like to a ridiculous point, how extreme the idea, you know, how dangerous the idea of a kid or any element from a kid's world getting into Monster World was.
I love the sock just because it's so tiny and insignificant, and they take it so seriously.
So if they take it this seriously, you know, imagine if a kid ever got in, it would be the worst thing ever. So of course, that's exactly what happened.
That's right. This shaving thing was a pretty hairy technical problem, no pun intended, but I think it worked out really great. In fact, even you can see on the floor when the CDA back up, their foot scrapes away some of the hair and that all reacts. It's really cool.
It's the details that count at Pixar Animation Studios. As John Lasseter likes to say, we sand the undersides of the drawers.
There are things in Monsters Incorporated that we could not have possibly done on Toy Story, A Bug's Life, in Toy Story 2. One of the things that happens here at Pixar is that the technical development is really driven by the needs of the story. And I think in Monsters Incorporated, one of the big things was to have furry monsters. And we started looking at a lot of different animals like
like gorillas, orangutans,
bison, and bears.
Yeah. And so we started thinking, you know, I think it's time to maybe address this. Typically, the more organic something is and the way it looks or moves, the more difficult it is to do with computer animation. And so with this one, we wanted these creatures, even though they are monsters, they're completely made up. We wanted to have it grounded in a sort of reality for the monster world. And we started looking at real animals and pull, you know, textures and surfaces and so on from the real animal world. But then we combined it, which I think was one of your big ideas, was the color.
What comes out of your closet is the figments of your imagination. And so I started to go, well, wait a minute, what would a kid think his monsters look like? And they tend to have a little bit of a fantastical quality to them. Again,
you know, there's more to life than... That shot there as Mike sniffs his armpit sells amazing to me. He can't turn his head.
He has no neck.
And he has no nose.
And we needed him to sniff his armpit, but animator Andrew Gordon did a great job pulling it off.
You know, I am so romantic, sometimes I think I could just marry myself.
Give me a break, Mike. What a
night of romance. So this whole sequence was originally staged to be in the parking lot with Roz in this hot rod. You know, she had this really fast-moving car in contrast to her slug nature, you know. And Sully and Mike were waiting for the bus to go home. But we couldn't afford to build the exterior and the bus, so we restaged the whole idea with pretty much the same story beats in the lobby, which is cool anyway because you get to see it again.
One of the tough things about computer graphics, unlike hand-drawn animation, is, you know, if we want a hot rod, we can't just draw it. We have to spend a long time actually building it, and if it's going to end up just being in one shot, it's hard to justify spending all that effort.
This is one of the many little improvs by Jennifer Tilly. Just, I don't understand you. You know, just this great little thing she would throw out and we would use peppered throughout.
She had just this great, coy, natural quality that we fell in love with. Leave the puce!
Pink copies go to accounting, the future ones go to Roz. This scene where Sully lets the little girl into Monster World has been there, really, kind of from the beginning.
Yeah, it's sort of the pivotal idea was monsters and kids. And very early on, we always thought of what if you brought a kid into the world of monsters rather than staying in the human world, which we'd have to mimic.
And have the main character let in what the monsters fear the most.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think it even drove that idea. We thought if a little kid came into the monster world, wouldn't that be the humor of everybody's more scared of it than just as if there was a monster in our world? And that sort of drove us to think of the movie like that
and
come up with the right plot machinations.
And that great twist that monsters are more scared of kids than kids are of monsters.
You never know where those big ideas are going to come from. That really kind of drove it. But every, you know, once that was in there, this scene has pretty much stayed the same for a long time. It's always been late at night, accidentally coming into an active door.
But this was one of the things that stayed unchanged was the idea Sully responds to this thumping noise, looks down, and there's Boo. Boo was voiced by Mary Gibbs, who's the daughter of Rob Gibbs, one of our story artists, our really great story artists.
She was about 2 1/2, right, when we first started recording her. She was at that great age where she was right on the cusp of language acquisition, where, you know, her
parents could understand her, but nobody else.
She felt like she was talking and had things to say, but she couldn't understand what she was saying. There was a lot of debate early on about how to deal with Boo's language. You know, we kind of vacillated between going this route, which is just that people can't understand what she's saying, and actually setting up this whole idea that in Monster World, humans just sound like gibberish.
Right.
And that ended up being a really complicated thing to get across.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how necessary. We had a shot where Sully was saying, "Do you understand?" And then you cut to Boo's point of view, and he's going,
right. But it ended up being cuter just to have her be kind of unintelligible and innocent.
I think in earlier drafts, she was about 6 in the film. And as we developed it, we realized the younger she is, the more dependent she is on Sullivan. And therefore really needs his help.
Back there were what we believe to be the first shots in computer-generated films of toilets.
Yeah,
we're very proud of. We actually have several shots of toilets in this film.
Another Pixar first. This here, this turn with Boo on his back, that was another thing that was early on a real tentpole thing that we stayed with, and people love it. I mean, we've had screams.
Yeah, at our very first preview, this woman actually let out a huge shriek at that moment. We knew we had pulled off the moment.
Kitty was one of the three words that Boo has to say in the film. It was just an idea that we had that she would, the absurdity of the idea that, you know, she sees this big, huge, 8-foot-tall, 1,000-pound guy and calls it Kitty. I think there was some difficulty here in stuffing Boo into the bag and just feeling uncomfortable with that idea that our main character is stuffing this kid into this little thing, but it came out okay because she has these little...
Yeah, we cut in some dialogue of her still just having a good time in there even though she's muffled.
This is a fake app. Worked out pretty well.
I always felt like that was like a setup for Randall being allergic to kids, but it's not.
Of course, Sully can't send the kid home, so he has to take her with him.
Where does he go? Go find Mike.
That's right. So the sushi restaurant, actually, initially, Harley Jessup, our production designer, one of the two production designers, had designed it more like a kitschy Trader Vic's with colored lights and big, thick pillars and a big sloping roof with a neon sign on the top. And it would have been really cool, but it would have been very expensive to build and not nearly as upscale. I mean, this is supposed to be one of the nicer places in town that Mike takes Celia.
This shot has one of the most disturbing images, I think, in the entire film, for me personally, and it's the toothpick skewering the eyeball on the tray in front of them.
In an earlier version of the story, Mike was going to propose to Celia, and Sully shows up and, of course, ruins the whole moment. And, you know, I can't remember why we dumped that. Maybe, you know what, let's call Dan Gerson. Let's see if I can get him on the phone right now. See what he says.
Hello?
Hi, Dan?
This
is Pete.
Hey, Pete, what's going on?
How's it going? I'm calling from Pixar. We're doing the commentary for the DVD, and had a question for you. You ready?
Shoot.
So, you know, we have Harryhausen's, and Mike and Celia are there, and it's her birthday. In an earlier draft, we had it that Mike was going to propose to Celia.
Right.
Do you remember why we took that out?
I know. When we were starting to work on this sequence, we realized that if Mike was going to ask Celia to marry him, it implied that there was already sort of a split happening in his relationship with Sully. These two guys were best friends. We wanted a split between them to happen when Boo came into their world. We wanted Boo to be the thing that potentially caused a rift. So we took out the marriage proposal because it would have stepped on that.
Genius.
Makes sense?
Makes sense. All right,
talk to you guys later.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye.
So Harryhausen's, the name of the restaurant, is obviously a reference to Ray Harryhausen, the great stop-motion animator of Jason and the Argonauts.
The Sinbad movies.
Right. And he was just a great influence on, I think, most of us growing up. He'd stay up late and see those cool movies on TV where he's fighting the skeleton.
And, wow. And of all other forms of animation, stop-motion is kind of the closest to what we do now in computer animated films.
Yeah.
So this whole... having the CDA show up here is, again, just to up the ante and show how incredibly dangerous it was for Boo to have been let into the world. That's our director, Pete Docter, there.
This hallway, or this alleyway here, is actually right next to Mike and Sully's apartment. We redressed it with more fire escapes, squished the buildings closer together to make it feel more like an alley. This TV news, we've showed it to a bunch of reporters and journalists, and they were amazed how get on we got them.
It was fun with the lighting and everything. We wanted to make it feel like these characters were all getting blasted in the face with little sun guns.
I love the background animation. I think this was Pete Nash who did this shot. Little characters waving and so on. Really cool. These guys, neither of them have legs because we never see them. We just modeled the sphere with the arms and so on.
But do any newscasters really have legs?
Well, when they made the toys... The toys don't have legs either, so if you buy the toys...
that's why they don't have legs.
This whole sequence was another one that came together pretty early on the boards, and I think the whole concept of these two huge guys scared out of their gourds as this innocent little girl walks around destroying their apartment is just inherently funny. Rob Gibbs was the guy who boarded a lot of this.
This the sequence is actually really seminal in terms of... nailing down Sully's physical acting and animation, right?
Yeah, early on we had him moving much slower because he's so big. Our thought was, okay, these big, huge guys, they can't really, to sell the weight, we have to slow them down. And what it was doing was actually slowing down the pacing of the whole film. So we found out that, you know, you could actually have him move pretty quick and still retain that feeling of weight. This crying, I actually videotaped my own kids, which, you know, you don't have to wait around too long if you have kids, you know.
You got toddlers.
That's right. You just wait about 5-10 minutes.
It's like waiting for a subway train.
Sure enough, off somebody goes. So, actually, the first pass through, we didn't have the snot. And as I was watching my daughter, I realized, okay, we need the snot. That's just one of those things that's going to round out. It's going to keep her from becoming a just sappy, cute characters to have that snot dripping down from her nose.
At the end of the scene here, we knew we wanted Boo to laugh and to have everything just, all the power blow out to show how powerful her laugh was. And one of my rules in films is you can't have a character laughing at something if the audience doesn't think it's funny. So we spent a long time coming up with a really, really funny gag that would actually get the audience to laugh along with Boo at that moment.
Do it again.
This candlelit lighting was very tricky to do, and it was actually one of the earlier things that we did in lighting. We looked at a lot of Renaissance paintings and Barry Lyndon.
The Stanley Kubrick film.
Right, which was actually lit by candles. They didn't even have any practical lights on the set. And in this film, you can see that each flame has a slight pulse and flicker to it to really get that candle feel. And the problem was that we animated that. You couldn't see it until it was rendered. So you'd have to do this animation, wait a day or two for the turnaround of the pulsing of the lights. And it drove Janet LaCroix and Joyce Powell, the two lighting leads on this sequence. They were just going crazy. The drawing here that Boo has was actually drawn initially by Harley Jessup, the production designer. He took it home to his 5-year-old son, Graham, who then copied it, so we have that authentic kid line quality. Here you can see, too, Sullivan's hands actually dent the chair. That was something that we spent quite a bit of time on, which I'm not sure in retrospect we should. I mean, it's a cool thing. It adds a lot of, you know, just contact. It's that extra mile.
We sand the underside of the drawers.
That's right. This was an idea we had early on. I really like the idea that Sully creates a little trail, and he's going to have Boo sleep over on this pile of newspaper like you would a puppy, you know, in case she goes to the bathroom or anything. And the cereal pouring out of the box was actually hand-animated frame by frame as opposed to a dynamics or simulation. It was animated by Dylan Brown.
Coming up here is some great Randy Newman music. It was kind of the first opportunity in the film for him to play a Boo theme, which we knew was very critical, not only as a turning point emotionally for Sully starting to bond with Boo, but we knew that it was going to be a theme that we would likely revisit at the end of the film when he has to say goodbye to her.
See? No monster in here. Well, now there is, but I'm not
here at this scene. We were really thinking of Sullivan as sort of a Walter Matthau type of guy. He's just grumble. I like the idea that he effortlessly scrapes these huge bricks,
cinder blocks
over there, and just kind of does it without even thinking, just nudges it with his fingers, shows his strength.
You go.
We had to animate an alternate version of that shot John Cars did for the international market, since it's so tied to English with him holding up the two fingers.
Boo falling right asleep was an idea that we had in story. And as we went to animation, I was worried initially that it would be she would read as she's narcoleptic or something. So we animated this whole kind of sleepy, slowly, eye-drooping thing, which was really appealing but didn't have the punch that this does, so we went back to it.
Hey, Mike, this might sound crazy, but I don't think that kid's dangerous.
Really? Well, in that case, let's take
it. Randy was a really great collaborator on this show, and he brought a lot of richness to the film in his orchestration and his musical ideas. As usual, one of the things Randy does so great is these musical themes that you tie to the characters or to different emotional ideas. And as Lee was saying, we use that same blues theme throughout the film and come back to it.
Sometimes on a solo piano, sometimes with full orchestration, and
really
it really
great.
Just pulls your heartstrings.
Yeah. This right here, the set, exterior set, about all that really exists is this foreground building, the one that says we scare because we care. The background is a matte painting, the giant door vault back there.
Hey, how you doing, Frank?
Hey, guys.
Everything's going to be okay.
Mike as a character came together pretty quickly, actually, compared to all the other guys. Ricky Nerva had drawn a little doodle of a guy with one eye, a little round character with one eye, and everybody just loved it. So Jeff Pigeon and Jason Katz, I think, were the two guys who boarded this sort of test scene. We didn't even have any actual bit of the film to board, and they came up with this little gag of Mike helping Sully choose a tie that he's going to wear to work. And they really defined his character very quickly.
He actually didn't have arms originally, right? He was just a big eyeball and a pair of legs.
Yeah, he just had two appendages, which we thought he could use as legs and arms, which was still a cool idea, but it was rather limiting and somewhat off-putting. So we figured we were limited enough just in the fact that he had one eye only. So
that ended up being a challenge, just being able to emote well with just a single eye.
Yeah, I think the animators did a great job. You don't ever really think about it. You don't think of him as a limited character. We essentially used the one brow as two. So in areas where one brow would come up and the other down, we just took that one brow and curved it in a way that mimics two brows.
This little scene here is really just a setup for the great scene that follows, where Boo is sitting in the stall having her little potty break.
Yeah. So to get Mary to sing, I had a puppet, and I don't remember, it was just the puppet that I made, and I said, "Yeah, Mary, would you sing for me?" And she said, "Okay," and she just started singing and then wouldn't stop. You want another song? She'd keep singing, and she was a little older by then.
So we took all that stuff back to the editing room and nipped and tucked and pieced together kind of a whole gibberish version of the song. And it's funny, this whole song has been kind of like a Rorschach test for people's psychologies, because everybody hears different things in the song, and there really seems to be no consensus about what she's actually singing.
She will save mankind. No, different things.
And I think she says lemon yellow kind.
Toilet flush was one of the first effects that we had, wasn't it? Is it the scene, or is it a different one?
It's actually earlier, but it's stunning. Okay. I think it's really, really cool.
We studied a lot of toilets. People taking videotape.
Other people go on research trips to Africa. We go to the lavatory.
Yeah, that's right. This is one of the cheats. One of the really the only cheats that we do in the film, where Boo is laughing here as she's playing, but the lights do not blow out.
Yeah, you know, we realized at a certain point that we had her kind of giggling throughout the movie and we weren't having lights explode everywhere, and we just decided to take that leap and not address it, because we wanted her to be cute and charming, but we didn't want it to become a big story point every time she giggled.
So here in Roz's station, you can see a lot of the props. We had this idea that we could pull props from other films, and it turned out to be somewhat of a myth. And so we actually had to rebuild everything from scratch, which actually was great, because it allowed us to really personalize and make these very particular things, you know, with the fangs and the way monsters would build them.
And like the handles on the cabinets back there are like horns.
Yeah.
And the tape dispenser. And you see that everywhere. You see that all at the beginning of the film in Monstropolis, all the little subtle details in the architecture. All have that kind of monster-y kind of feeling.
Some of the paperwork in Ross's office is actually real production reports from the production of the film.
There's actually a lot of meticulously created Monsters, Inc. paperwork that somebody had a lot of time on their hands, but hopefully you'll be able to look at them somewhere on this DVD.
Yeah.
and see all the great work that went into them.
Yeah.
All right, carry on.
One challenge here was that Randall's supposed to wash his hands. He can't anywhere near reach the sink. His hands are way too short, which you can see in this side shot. We had to really stretch his arms out.
You kind of fake that. That happens often. The story guys come up with really great funny things for the characters to do, and then the reality is that the characters can't actually do them, so we have to be creative.
Randall's camouflage is actually a big cheat, too. You know, he camouflages by grabbing elements of the background and applying that texture to him. But if you think about it, if you moved the camera off-center or looked at him from the side, that camouflage wouldn't work at all. You know, you'd be able to see him standing right there. But there again, I think it's one of those movie liberties.
Yeah, we played kind of fast and loose, and we kind of straddled between it being camouflage and being kind of an invisibility kind of a thing.
Until we know for sure, we're going to act like nothing happened.
More great performance from Frank Oz there. It's
yeah.
Great. And when we did the recording sessions with him, you know, you get a little hint of Yoda here and there, or Grover, or Miss Piggy all of a sudden.
Yeah, that was another case where we worked with Frank and with Steve Buscemi at the same time, and I think they really pushed each other.
Mm-hmm.
This bit of toilet paper stuck to Mike's foot. Mark Henn was responsible for it, and it was actually very difficult to make sure it could read.
Those little things that are so easy to do in hand-drawn animation end up being kind of a bear to do in CG.
And it was a Dynamics. It wasn't hand keyframe animated. It was a Dynamics solution.
Wasn't that bit where Mike and Sully was coming in saying hi to everybody originally somewhere else in the film?
Oh, like the top of the morning stuff. Yeah. It was in the lobby. And I think we switched it to this place.
It was always so funny.
Yeah.
The way that John and Billy just were absolutely hilarious. Did you lose a limb? You lose weight or a limb or something. I just loved that. And so we had to use it, and it fit perfectly here.
Yeah, it kept it moving instead of just standing still.
We originally had another piece of yodeling music in here that actually came from Pete's vast collection of yodeling records.
Yes.
And it was really funny stuff, but we couldn't get the rights to it. It was such an old recording, they couldn't track it down, so we ended up having to create another version of the yodeling that was funny. I don't think it's quite as funny as what used to be in there, but it's pretty funny.
Yeah, it works. This was another scene where we recorded with Billy and John together. One of the things that John Goodman did that I wasn't expecting at all was to start singing along with Mike, and it really works great. It you know, ties everything together. These guys are on the same page. They both can, you know, think as fast as each other. One of the things I'm really pleased with was, and I think David Silverman was largely responsible for it. He was the co-director and really worked in story a lot. Sully and Mike are not a straight man comedy relief team. They both kind of can rib each other. They can both tell jokes or play pranks on each other. They're more like college roommates. And I think that was something that was really great to bring to the show.
I love this idea of Randall bumping into Sully and kind of momentarily taking on his texture here.
What are you two doing?
It's kind of the only time that happens in the film, but it's a great idea.
What do you think of that kid getting there?
You know, I remember Randall not having a shtick early on, and me just saying, can he do something cool like a chameleon? Like, can he turn into something? And of course, technically, we could not do that, but it got everybody thinking, and we just couldn't drop it. You know, once that was out there in the room, everybody kind of go, yeah, it would be cool.
But with the technology, they can snapshot a picture of the background, mm-hmm. and then use that actually as a texture map. I remember the discussion, and it turned out to be so cool, but there was all this discussion. Okay, should he move and you see the background like, you know, like Felix is a cat magic bag or something,
right.
Or should it be like, you know, should it be just like, sort of him standing still? But when we finally came up with the right combination, it really was so special because it was kind of creepy. It meant like he could be anywhere.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
You can't talk about Randall because he could be invisible right behind
you. Totally worked.
This painting, I think, was a really fun idea of sort of playing on that old haunted house thing with the painting's eyes start to look at you, and then there comes Randall. You're not pinning this on me. This was hopefully fairly obvious, but Randall is up to this weird plot, and Mike and Sully, and hopefully the audience too, believe that he's basically just cheating to get ahead, to boost his numbers, to be able to beat Mike and Sully. And so that's what Randall just plays along with that.
Everyone
There's actually, I remember an earlier version of the scene that was pretty funny. It had Mike hiding in a room, and there was a window looking into the room, and Mike looked up to see Randall kind of glaring in at him and moving his finger like, come here, I spotted you. And we then cut out to the hallway and realized that Randall's just looking at a mirror. It's like a one-way mirror, and he's actually kind of picking something out of his teeth. But Mike thinks he's been caught, so he essentially just gives himself up. I always thought it was a really funny little bit, but sometimes those things go by the wayside.
That's right. Here in the hallway, you can see it's basically the same. I think we had four or five, like a grid work of halls, and we try to make them look different by putting different textures on the walls between the wood and the...
This is kind of the executive wing.
Yes. And there's a bunch of different placards, on the wall. There it says, Be Brute, behind where the geeks come out of.
It's an office of inhuman resources.
That's right.
We kind of got a little more comic with the CDA here, which, it was just to have a little fun with them and not keep them quite so personality-less.
Yeah. Garbage is one of the most difficult things to model convincingly. We took a lot of the props that we had and beat them up a little bit as best we could. And coming up here in the trash cube was actually very, very difficult. We took individual pieces and stuck them all together and tried to squish them, and that sort of worked. But what we ended up doing was taking a picture of that. Any given side, we took a picture of it and did a little bump map onto it so that it looks as though it's been squished together.
What's your name?
Mike Wazowski.
This whole section is borrowed, shall we say, from one of all of our favorite cartoons. And so we took the basic idea of that. And
Doug Sweetland animated all those shots on Sully, right?
Yeah, really great stuff.
This is a tricky scene because we didn't want to get too serious with it. He really thinks Boo's getting crushed in this machine, but we didn't want to play, real anguish because that would be kind of a downer. So we kind of took the risk of playing it a little more comical here.
There's some nice Brett Kader animation and faint.
The sequence of Mike running around trying to find Sully used to be a longer sequence. There's actually some great stuff we animated of him running around trying to find them, but ultimately we just wanted to keep the movie moving along, so we trimmed it down somewhat.
I don't remember who had the idea of CDA all in the toilet stalls, but it really cracked us up.
Hey, everybody's got to go sometime.
That's right. We figure they have hoses that detach. They don't actually unzip their suits.
And that's all the detail we're going to go into.
That's right. So Sully's here with the cube. This again is Brett Kader animation and of Sullivan.
Gary Rydstrom did a great little sound effect right there when the lamp tips forward. It's kind of an homage to John Lasseter's short film Luxo Jr. Did a little Luxo vocalization in there. How many kids you got in
there? These kids again were mostly our own kids that we brought in to say Mike Wazowski.
There's just something great about kids when they're not acting and they don't know what they're doing, they don't know you're recording them. You get just kind of a great, real, charming quality to the voice.
What an affectionate father.
Actually, she's my cousin's sister.
Okay, Sully. Let's go.
So this character here, the voice was the daughter of Joe Ant. Joe is one of our great story guys and the voice of Wheezy in Toy Story 2 and Heimlich in Bug's Life. And his daughter, Sophia, did the voice.
Okay. Mike Kakowski.
Yeah. Those guys hitting each other. I think that's actually Lee,
That's
daughter.
My daughter, Hannah,
and my son, Nicholas. Okay, let's move. Come on. So the lighting here on the scare floor, I think, is really great. We based it on a cathedral or Grand Central Station, that light, bright light coming in from outside. It's one of four or five different lighting setups that we have on the scare floor. And Dominique Louis, who is an art director, did the way he would basically work was he would take the layouts, paint on using pastels, paint on the basic lighting setup, and then those would go to the lighting artists who would use them as an inspiration to start from. And
it's amazing to look at these pastels. You basically, it's like looking at the entire movie, and it's very close to how all the individual shots ended up getting lit. They're just like pieces of art in their own right.
Hopefully you have a chance to see those on this very disc.
One of the reasons for this scene being here is that we thought it would be really cool to have a scene where Randall camouflages And we don't know where he is. And we know he could be anywhere in the room, and there's this threat that he could, you know, show up at any moment and, you know, kind of keep the music to a minimum and just really let this moment be really kind of chilling.
Jerry Rydstrom had an idea to, every time Randall camouflages, to use just a little bit of sound from what he's camouflaging into, so you can hear the cans kind of clink as he disappears.
One of our concerns at this point in the film is that we had been spending so much time at Monsters, Inc. in the hallways. We were worried that things, it was going to start to feel, you know, a little claustrophobic. So at this point in the film, we introduced this idea of the secret lair, which gave us an opportunity to bring some new design and new locations into the story.
Of course, the only way to a secret lair is through a secret entrance.
Wasn't the entrance to the secret lair like a candy machine originally, right?
Yes, that's my fault. It was in my script. I'm to blame.
Now, what was the name of the candy again?
It's called Juicy Fright. And there was a larger plot that we were aware of at the time that in my script. And so I love, you know, geeky setups. And I thought, what if there was this candy machine that was always out of order and Mike always wanted to get stuff from it? And there one and the way to get it actually covered the hole that brought you to the secret lair. And if you ordered Juicy Fright, it would open up and you'd go down. And it worked for a long time. But then as the more we decided to leave the audience out of the know, that there was something going on, and the more we wanted people not to think that Waterness had anything to do with it, it couldn't be so high-tech. It had to be low-tech. It had to be sort of this makeshift door.
And more inconspicuous.
Yes.
Because, I mean, with a candy machine there, you'd think
somebody would have fixed it.
Yeah, somebody would have wanted the candy and fixed it and all like that.
It seemed good on paper. Okay.
Yeah.
The pipes overhead were actually built originally. Sully was a refinery guy. He worked back in the refinery and extracted scream out of cans. And as the story developed and he became top scarer instead, we cleaned out the pipes from the scare floor and used them here underground.
The pipes are actually really interesting. We knew we wanted to have this whole kind of maze network of pipes everywhere, and we didn't want to have to build them all kind of, you know, for each instance by hand. So we developed this whole system we called Pipe-O-Matic.
Right. And the Pipe-O-Matic is a shader system where you can take... Shaders are the textures on the surfaces. You can turn up rust or turn down dust or speckling or texture and all sorts of things. You have a great amount of control and flexibility so that you can... They're very flexible pieces.
So it's basically like having a big Tinker Toy set of pipes to work with.
Yep.
And we actually ended up using the pipes to build lots of other things in the movie, too. Sophie Vincelette and her set dressing team, the Pipe-O-Matic proved to be really versatile,
yeah,
making stands for lamps and all kinds of things.
The lighting in this section, I think, works really great. And one of the ideas behind it is that the refining is being done up above where we are. We're in sort of the subterranean level that you're not actually supposed to be in. Nobody ever goes down here. And so the light you can see spills in and just little leaks of this sort of orangey green light.
The scream extractor design is really, really cool because it's actually built out of lots of other machinery we've already seen in the movie. The main arm is kind of a piece of a door station, and it's not that we're trying to just reuse props. It's the idea that the characters kind of used what they had to put together this horrible machine.
Yeah, they're just doing this on their own, you think, at the time, and they're building it out of spare parts. That's the side of the door. The door station you can see there.
And their little console there is kind of made up out of the keypads that control the door stations.
Yeah.
Some more Pipe-O-Matic here you see in the foreground that we're kind of moving by with Randall.
So this was a Dan Gerson line. He's one of our writers on the show. The car thing. So that was really funny. And, of course, here the idea is that Sully has somehow snuck up in the overhead pipes. And
we actually used to have a lot of stuff in the story where Sully was up in the pipes.
Right.
We had a version of the scene later on where he comes back and rescues Boo, where he kind of dangles upside down and gets her out of the chair while nobody's watching, which ended up being just a little far-fetched.
Yeah. this whole idea of the lips. We actually tried a bunch of different stuff to just what was the funniest, you know, in terms of the redness and puffiness, and ended up here.
Come on.
Chris, he's gonna kill us!
Careful, that could be contaminated.
We gotta get out of here now! We can start a whole new life.
This part right here, Mike is standing, and you can see outside. That's just only through lighting that we sold that was outside. We parked a car. It's just another room. Another room outside. We parked a car and lit it brightly, and it looks like outside.
No, 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 no. What was that? You're trying to scare the kid.
Here we're back to the tryout room, where Thaddeus is trying once again to do a good job.
That's Jeff Pigeon, one of our great story guys, did the voice of Thaddeus Bile, and Jeff also, his most famous part was as the little squeeze toy aliens in the Toy Story films.
Sir, you don't understand.
Now, show these monsters how it's done.
I can't, sir, you have
to... So this was a really tricky part of the film. Sullivan ends up scaring Boo without knowing it, and... We had done one version where Boo was basically in Mike's arms throughout this whole scare, and as we had actually finished animating it.
Yeah, it was all done. The scene was finished, and Ed Catmull, the president of Pixar, got in touch with us. He'd seen a screening of the film, and it just wasn't sitting quite right with him. He felt like the emotional impact of Sully scaring Boo could be stronger, and he had this idea of Boo actually kind of running up and getting close to Sully when he does the scare. And it was a great idea, and we made the changes necessary to have the scene play out that way. And there's just much more visceral impact to the moment of Sully scaring Boo the way we ended up restaging it.
It's funny, there's a lot going on in this scene. There's a lot of exposition of Mike saying, oh, the Randall has this plot, and he has to tell Waterness about it, and then so on and so on. And at the same time, there's this emotional stuff of Sully dealing with the fact that he's just scared this kid that he's grown to love and care for. And I was really concerned early on that we needed to get more of that exposition out of the way, but as is always the case, it's really the emotion that that carries it.
Yeah, it was really critical for Sully's character at this point. We wanted to really put him through the ringer. We wanted him to feel like, it's like when you have kids and, you know, say you're taking them out of the car and you bonk their head on the door frame. You feel really bad about it. You know, something bad happens that was your fault, and all you want to do at that moment is take it back. And we wanted Sully to kind of feel those parental feelings at this moment.
Does anyone else know about this?
So once again, even though there's all this exposition going on of, oh, I can't believe this happened to my company and so on, Sully has really remained focused on the fact that Boo has been scared, and he feels awful about that. This was a kind of a far-fetched idea initially, is that the tryout simulator that doesn't actually do anything is hooked up somehow to the overhead track. But yeah, I think you buy it.
You do. I mean, we had to do it both to bring in the banishment door, but also to set up Sully's switcheroo on Waternoose at the end of the film.
Well, we had initially had him take them all to the scare floor and banish them there, but it just was extra time that we didn't need to spend.
I remember in one of Andrew's early scripts, he had this cut where we cut to the Himalayas, and there was actually text on the screen that said, "Somewhere in the Himalayas." And I thought that was so great. It was just such a 180-degree turn. I thought, wow, I want to see that movie.
Yeah.
That's exactly what always happens, is eventually we turn back into audiences of our own film, and we just go, and something's just not working. You just want to shake it up. And I remember saying to you, Peter, you know, something crazy just needs to happen here. Like suddenly they're thrown through a door, and boom, they're in the Himalayas. And we just honestly said, well, geez, why not? And, you know, and then figure out from there how the heck you're going to make that work for the movie. But you know that's what you want. It's what you want as an audience member.
Yeah, you want the audience just to go, okay, how are they going to get back now?
Right, right.
Welcome to the Himalayas!
Yeti's Cave.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. We must have boarded this sequence literally 30 to 40 times. I'm not kidding. It's just... And poor Rob Gibbs, who's actually the father of Mary, the voice of Boo, he ended up doing most of them. Although Joe Ramft did a couple of them, too. It was just a really tricky scene. I mean, there's so much emotional weight here between Sully and Mike. You know, the whole film, basically their friendship has been tested. And this is the point where it breaks. In fact, early on, we had them get back together in this scene and both go on back to the...
And it was just too easy. It was too easy in such a short scene to take them all the way to their friendship breaking up and then getting them back together.
Yeah.
We knew for a long time that we wanted to have John Ratzenberger play the Yeti. You know, John's been in all of our films. He plays Ham in the Toy Story movies, and he was P.T. Flea in A Bug's Life, and we like to think of him as our lucky charm here at Pixar.
In the background there, you see a box of lingonberry jam. There was a whole gag that we had at the beginning of the scene was after Sully and Mike see the Yeti in the snow, instead of saying, "Welcome to the Himalayas," he just roared. And then you cut to him eating what looks like blood on a knife.
And the camera slowly pulled back and revealed he was just eating jam.
Right. Jam?
Yeah,
some terrified mountain
jam.
Climbers left it behind.
I remember when we first came up with the idea for the snow cones.
Mm-hmm.
And we said we wanted them to be yellow and to have them go, "Oh, no, it's lemon." You know?
Right.
We love that. And what's interesting is it was really late in the production. And the way that they had rendered them, we just didn't have time to put much detail in them.
Yeah.
And the joke was falling flat. And it was Darla Anderson, the producer, that came in and said, "You know, I don't care if we don't have time. We have got to make those look better."
Yeah.
And she insisted, and they did. They made them look fantastic.
Bright yellow.
Yeah, bright yellow, and it looks like a snow cone where the it has all the ice.
You know, crystallized and everything.
For
those of you raised in the Northern Hemisphere, you'll know that that was accurate, you know.
And what's very funny is that texture change made all the difference in the world. Then the joke started landing.
Yes, it's amazing what a difference
yeah.
a shade of yellow will make.
Yeah.
It was kind of an 11th hour edition, yeah. And I think it's pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
"Oh, would you look at that? We're out of snow cones. Let me just go outside and make..."
In addition to boarding this scene tons of times, we actually recorded it quite a few times with John Goodman and Billy Crystal. And in those early versions, the scene just wasn't working, and you could tell the two of them, you know, being great actors, were really struggling with the scene because it just wasn't feeling real. And when we finally got the scene working right near the end of the process, it was clear to everybody involved that we had finally nailed it, because they were both able to really invest themselves emotionally in the material, and I think they both did some of the best work that they did on the film.
Yeah, you could tell in the room that it was just working. But booze in trouble. The lighting and the shaders in this scene are really beautiful. We worked hard to get a sort of backlit translucency to the ice, that you feel like it is ice, that there's some amount of light coming from outside, from the moonlight. There's various textures of the snow that all have to... This whole cave, unlike most rooms that has a floor and a ceiling and so on, the whole thing is one piece. So it was actually very tricky to get the shaders to look right, to smooth. Again, the translucency you can see on the sides of the icicles as well.
I'm actually happy that, except for the very end of the scene, there's no music in this scene. It's easy to fall on the crutch of putting music in everywhere, and
yeah.
I think the scene is much more effective by not having any music.
This whole scene was an idea that Lee had to just get him out of there and to have a bit of action now after this slow bit. And to do it, we had actually built this sort of pizza-like model of snow around the door, the one door that they get banished out of. And so we tipped it on its side, added a bunch of rocks into it, and that became his sled ride down the hill.
And the goal was to just make as exciting a little sequence out of it as possible, and just make him feel really triumphant and like he was in control of everything, and he was going to go rescue Boo, and at the last minute yank the rug out from under him and have him just completely wipe out with no hope of accomplishing his goal.
Steve May did the effects on this shot of Sully wiping out in the snow, and I think it's one of the more amazing shots
in
the film.
Yeah, I think it's really, really cool.
Here we go back to George.
"Oh, come on now, George. I know you can do this. I picked out an easy..."
That's Phil Proctor from the Fireside Theater doing the voice of
Charlie.
Of Charlie.
"Right. Here, take this. Go get him, Georgie. Get him,
look out." Finally, George gets his comeuppance there. He's not going to stand for being 23-19 anymore. So now we go back to Boo, who's now and captured and put into the chair.
We actually used to have a whole extended sequence in here where Sullivan ran down and he thought he was bursting into the room where Boo was, but he actually burst into a room full of cages. This giant room full of cage after cage after cage that was basically setting up the idea that this was going to be a giant operation and they were going to be, you know, extracting stream from lots of kids. And they
it set up that exposition and was sort of a surprise for people that instead of, ta-da, there he is, he was in a cage room instead.
Right, and it was cool. It was cool that this idea that this operation, this was going to be a huge operation, but ultimately it was just really slowing down the pacing of the film, and we thought it was more important just to have Sully burst in and rescue Boo and kind of move on with the movie.
Yeah, I mean, she's the only kid we know at this point in the film, so she's the only one we care about.
It was very difficult to, I think we were doing it well in terms of setting up the idea clearly of what was going on, but ultimately we decided that hopefully the audience was just going to gather that this was going to be an ongoing operation with lots of kids.
This idea of Sullivan having to fight an invisible force, you never know where he is. He's really fast, he's really quick, strong, and invisible, made him... It was a challenge, actually, because his design was such that he looked like kind of a wimp.
And it was important that people not think, oh, why doesn't Sully just, grab him and deck him? You know, Sully's obviously such a much bigger guy. It was important for the climax of the film in the door vault that Randall be a real threat.
Right.
And be seen as a really dangerous character to Sully. And this sequence was really designed to do just that.
So here again, we're teetering on an edge between actual tension and drama and the comedy of sort of slapstick fight stuff, stuff that Sully's doing. Trying to make it funny and appealing to people, but still
you want to have
that
you want to have the threat,
right,
in danger of Randall, but not have it be too violent.
Yeah. I always love this idea that Randall's exposed by being hit by the snowball, that's where you can finally see where he is.
Come on!
So Jennifer Tilly, when she was recording these screams, she would back up across the room, run towards the microphone, and scream at the top of her lungs. Method acting. She was great. This scene here is actually pretty tricky technically. The fact that Sullivan is pulling these guys across the floor and still bouncing up and down and all this. A lot of attaches. Mike was asked, that's another one of the words that Mary Gibbs actually had to say. I think she says, Mike Wazowski,
Kitty.
Boo, and Kitty.
Yeah, and that's about it.
So here we were really trying to involve, everybody really loved Celia as we were developing her as a character, as the story was coming together. Trying to use her to defeat Randall in some way.
We wanted to give her kind of one last little moment in the sun because we knew we were going to be basically losing her till the end of the film.
So we're trying to think, okay, we'll use her receptionist skills, right? so she uses the phone to do the overhead page. And then we went back in the film and layered in some other pages that you can hear.
We used to have a more kind of female computer voice doing all the announcements about the scare leader on the scare floor. And we ended up replacing those all with Jennifer Tilly to set up that idea.
So as soon as we came up with an idea that the monster scare kids through the closet door, we knew that then somewhere there needed to be a place where they housed. I think we did calculations of like 36 million doors of all the kids around the world that they scare. And as soon as we had that idea, I knew we had a great climax of this roller coaster ride. Not only is it a roller coaster, as you can see in this section, which is really fun, but it's also a chase around the world, because you can go through any door and be anywhere in the world.
This is the kind of scene where when you describe it for the first time to the technical people who are actually going to have to help you create the sets and be able to render it, it's the kind of moment where you can hear a pin drop.
Yeah. This vault is taller than the Empire State Building, and it's, I think, a half a mile long.
It can actually fit, we figured out, a Statue of Liberty on any one given level of the door vault.
Yeah, it's massive. And Tim Milliron came up with he was one of the technical directors on the show, came up with a way to actually render all the doors. We were initially thinking we were going to have to do tons of cheating and maybe paint and stuff like that, but he came up with a way to trick the computer into thinking that these flat pieces of paper are actually doors, you know, that they have some relief to them and so on.
This is, if you listen to the music here in Hawaii, it's actually me playing the ukulele with Bruno Kuhn, our music editor, and Pete's on the upright bass.
Yeah, and Bruno actually wrote all the music for the other international rooms as well. All the rooms that we go into and out of in this section are basically one of two rooms. There's a generic room and Boo's room. And the generic room we would just turn and twist in different ways, texture it, color it differently, and that's basically how
this,
we do it.
This whole sequence, I think, is a real tour de force for everyone concerned. It was a real challenge from a layout perspective in terms of designing all the staging and the camera movement and compositions. One of the cool things about computer animation is that we are able to shoot our scenes as though we're shooting live action. You know, we have these sets built and we have these little virtual cameras that we can go in and shoot angles and shoot coverage, shoot multiple angles, and then come back to the cutting room and kind of put it all together before we actually animate. So it allows us to create some really great dynamic scenes and dynamic staging.
This whole thing with the falling, I also thought was really cool, that they're falling, and the way they escape is to actually go into the thing on which they're falling. It's just something that wouldn't have been possible in any other film, really. Sullivan's fur is one of the big, big technical achievements in this film, and I think this sequence shows it off
really
well.
Really shows it off.
It's a dynamic thing. So the animators are kind of like the actors in their show. They bring the personality, the performance to the character, and they worked with basically a bald version of Sullivan.
Yeah, you don't want them to get bogged down in kind of the physics of how hair moves. You just want them to concentrate on the performance.
3 million hairs, so it would have been just impossible for them to animate it by hand. So once their performance is done, that whole thing is fed into the simulation program, which moves the fur. In here, we have an added layer of complexity because they're moving through space, and to get that effect, we set up a wind generator on the fur, and shot by shot, we had to call out different amounts of that wind depending on how fast he was meant to be going. This, again, this idea of the two worlds colliding here at this threshold, you see a kid's room careening through space in the door vault was one of those things that just from early on I was really excited about.
It was cool to be stable inside the room yet see the whole monster world outside the door moving. It's the only time in the film that we do it, and it's really cool. This is another change that we made kind of late in the game, was kind of really pumping up this Randall's comeuppance and Boo's triumph over Randall. This used to be a kind of a much shorter little bit and didn't have her bonking him on the head with the bat and all the color changing and everything. We realized at an early preview that the audience really wanted to cheer for Boo, and we weren't quite there yet, so we spent some time kind of pumping up the scene and letting Boo kind of have a real triumph over her fears and over Randall.
I'm not scared of you anymore.
Randall's comeuppance was something that Nate Stanton, who is one of the story artists on the show, he came up with this idea that Randall gets stuck in the swamp, you know, and mistaken for a gator. And so
down in the bayou.
And it's stuck.
That's, of course, the trailer from A Bug's Life that the Pizza Planet truck parked outside.
And inside are two versions of the Sim Kid, the simulated kid at the beginning of the show. And they're just used, you know, you can see their shadows. I think we put an extra sphere in the back of one to make it look like Mom.
Like a bun.
Yeah.
That's right, Boo. You did it.
This is, of course, to, you know, set up the idea that Boo's about to go home and everything's kind of happy feeling.
Hey, Boo, it's time to go home.
Pull out the rug again.
Yep.
Be a good girl, okay?
So Mike's move that brings down the house, we had animated Sean Krause, one of the animators on the show. He'd done, I think, 3 or 4 different moves that he could have done, just little kind of dance steps, and maybe one, I think he did one where Mike accidentally slipped, beamed himself between the legs, but we really felt like it was the most painful for him to intentionally do it, and then the humor is that Boo didn't actually see him go through all this agony.
Hold on!
The door lands in the station, cut the power. You'll have the child.
This the scenes coming up here where Mike kind of fakes everybody out by throwing, having a sock appear in his mouth and throwing it at the CDA was something that we always had early on. But we were worried that, you know, they just came up with this idea at the last moment. Where did they get the sock from? We thought, well, it's Boo's sock. Well, Boo was wearing both of her socks for the rest of the film, so we had to look into the possibility of taking off one of her socks, which was a problem.
So initially, the technical directors, the modelers, were saying, oh, okay, it's going to take another 3-4 weeks to build the foot.
Because we didn't actually have the foot that went inside the sock. We just had a sock.
Well, it turns out we actually did have the foot. It was built long ago as a, kind of a base on which to build the sock. So we pulled that out of the archives and put it on her stump of a leg. And there Boo has bare feet through the rest of the film.
Some great Doug Sweetland animation here of Waternoose really turning him completely from a grandfatherly, trusted character into a really powerful, violent, scary guy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of debate about this moment. We wanted to set up this whole switcheroo that, you know, Sully's trying to make Waternoose, trying to trick Waternoose into thinking that he's actually activating Boo's door here, but of course he knows he's not doing that.
So for those of you who are taking notes, he pushes the wrong button.
And we never show the red light go on over the door because it wouldn't have really gone on. It's one of those tricky things where we were really thinking through the logic of the moment, and we had to catch ourselves and not get too caught up in trying to explain away exactly what was going on.
As soon as we came up with that idea of faking it out, we knew that then we had to go back and re-engineer both the simulator room and Boo's room to be very close to each other in architecture, in color, and actually they're not. I mean, this is a total lighting cheat here that it looks somewhat pink. That's Boo's room color. And then you'll see when the lights come on here that it's more of a yellow. And, you know, it's a stage-type setup, so I think we have that liberty.
Simulation terminated.
Well, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I spotted several big mistakes.
This monitor bank of 6 different monitors. We took the same animation. That's one of the cool things of 3D animation. We took the same animation, set up 6 different cameras, and looked at it from those 6 different views. One of the things that wasn't so cool was that it didn't really always hold up. So we had to reanimate some stuff, do a lot of lighting tweaks to get that to read. And then, on top of all that, go through this video post-process to make it look as though it was on TV with the scan lines and the pause effect and all that.
It does look cool.
Stay where you are. Number one wants to talk to you.
This whole idea that Roz was number one, I don't remember where that came from, but it really struck us as sort of absurdly funny. And hopefully by now the audience realizes this is a comedy and you just sort of go with it. She's been doing this undercover work.
I love that she's still got a sweater on. It's now a yellow CDA sweater.
That's right.
I think this is some of Bob Peterson's finest work as the voice of Roz.
That's right. So Roz basically moves very slowly. The sort of rule of thumb is the less movement she does, the more true it is to her character, except her mouth. She can really pretty extreme with her mouth shapes, and that was one of the things that made her still feel alive and interesting.
I'll give you 5 minutes.
So the button here that Sullivan pushes to activate the door is labeled FizzT, which is the name of the tool which does the physical simulation of Sullivan's fur and Boo's shirt as well. That was another thing, like Sullivan, where the animators were focused on the performance, the movement of the underlying body, and the shirt is then draped over and dynamically moves and folds in the right way. So to me, this is really one of the key emotional things about the film. I think the whole film really relies and rests on the relationship between Sully and Boo. And actually, very early on, we didn't even have Mike in the film. It was all about Sullivan and Boo. And this scene is really where he has to say goodbye to her, and he's grown to really care for her and love her as a parent. And for me, it was always kind of the idea that I have kids, and someday those kids are going to grow up, and they're going to leave. And that's really sad, but it's beautiful. It's part of life. And I think it's something that people relate to, that adults relate to when they watch this film.
When Randy Newman first played us this solo piano version of Boo's theme, it just brought tears to All of Our Eyes. I think it's the most beautiful piece he wrote in the entire film. And I think this moment could have easily been kind of overpowered by, you know, too much music. And I think his choice to go down to the solo piano really, it just is emotionally powerful.
Yeah. We worked really hard here on, if you can see Sullivan as Boo hugs him, these tears, his eyes get really glossy, and these wells of tears kind of accumulate in the bottoms of his eyes. And we worked really hard to get that to work just right in a very subtle way that doesn't make you go, oh, he's crying, tears are running down his cheeks. It's just a subtle little thing that I think works even better. Here, Boo runs over to the door. She actually grows about 7% as she runs to the door because she's not tall enough to reach the doorknob. So the animator stretched her out, just grew her just a little bit. You can't tell. This, the inside of the closet, is a nice painting done by Glenn Kim, who's one of our painters on the show. The door shredder itself was kind of tricky because we wanted to have these particles flying up and in the air to show you that it was shredding the door. And at the same time, we had the story point that you needed every piece to put the door back together in order for it to work. So we kind of arrived at they're small enough to be kind of dust, you know, sawdust type things.
But they're still big chunks that Mike can ultimately put back together.
There we had to have that shot looking up because there's nothing over there. You know, the shot of the truck driving away.
Roger Rose animated this shot with all the characters, and he's kind of become one of our fallbacks for any shot that has a ton of characters in it. It's like, who's going to animate this? Well, Roger will do it.
Lucky Roger. He did a great job. This shot here, we initially had Sully just stopping short and kind of staring. And we felt like it was important for the audience to be clued in that he has some particular idea, something that he's going to try for the future. These shots we tried to mimic as closely as possible, the exact same shots from the beginning of the film.
And it's the same score and everything at this moment.
We had a real challenge disguising the fact that that's Mike, because he's so recognizable even in silhouette.
Billy loved this idea of kind of a failed stand-up comedian's act. He really had a great time with it.
Yeah, he did a great job. But it's funny because it's so... He's dying so badly.
Yeah.
You know?
The topper to this moment for a long time was Mike just kind of, I think he threw his microphone up in the air and it bonked him on the head and he fell off his stool, and that's what made the kid laugh.
Comedy,
yeah, it's doing some physical comedy. And it broke my rule of you can't have a character laugh at something that the audience isn't laughing at. Nobody laughed at it, so we came up with this whole kind of gross out idea with the belch. Because, hey, burps are funny.
That's right. The thing that really makes it for me is the fact that the kid just loves it, you know. It's the best thing he's seen in years.
When all else fails, belch.
So the scare floor here is, of course, the same. Well, it's actually now transformed into the laugh floor. It's the same architecture and everything with some new set dressing and new signage and so on, trying to make it look as cheerful as possible.
The Think Funny banner in the background, kind of an homage to our CEO, Steve Jobs' other company.
That's right.
Apple Computer.
Girls, so Mike goes to grab this magazine, and of course he's once again been covered up. Business Shriek.
For a long time, before we finally got this rendered, there, whenever Mike opened the box, it was just an image of the sushi bar, and it made absolutely no sense. And we knew what was going to be on the cover ultimately, but it was literally months before we finally got a render with that magazine cover on it. The moment finally made sense.
So I love the idea that Thaddeus is now using his failed scare to amuse kids.
Mm-hmm. It's also really cool. I don't think people immediately recognize it, but the, you know, because laughter is so much more powerful than a scream, we now have these huge tanks to hold the more powerful scream. And it's kind of a subtle thing, but it's pretty cool. It's always tricky with these films. This film kind of needed to have kind of an extended ending. You know, we have multiple scenes after Boo goes back home. You know, when Sully says goodbye to Boo, it kind of feels like the film's approaching its ending. Yet we still have several scenes here. And it's always a difficult balancing act to pull that off because
people
get a sense that the movie's ending, but you know we really wanted this reunion here at the end to have a lot of emotional impact, and if we had rushed into it, it wouldn't have had the same feeling that it has.
Early on, my initial thought was that once Sully says goodbye to Boo, he can never see her again, and once he does that, then we have sort of an ending with Mike and Sully again. And we kind of struggle with that because the audience really wants to see her again. And we came up with this, I think, very successful ending that allows you to have the feeling that they get together again, but you don't actually get to see her.
We got a lot of reaction from test screening audiences that they really wanted to see an image of Boo at the end. And rather than cave into that and give them that, we decided that we had done our job well because the audience wanted to see her so badly.
Leave them wanting more.
You know, when we came up with the initial idea, we wanted to tap into what was familiar to the audience, and that is that, you know, kids are scared in their bedrooms in the dark. They're afraid of monsters coming out of their closets. And so when we started getting into the story, It was really fun to sort of play into that notion and then immediately change it and show that monsters are in fact far more scared of kids than kids are of monsters. And it's fun to sort of, you know, play into the audience's expectation and what is familiar to them and then immediately show it to them in a way that they've never seen before.
And it's kind of, I don't think we were conscious of it at the time, but very quickly we said that's kind of fundamental to just the reality of a kid overcoming their fears. Sooner or later you find out that there's nothing to be scared of under your bed or in your closet, and you grow up and you've overcome your fears. And so
You've overcome your fears?
I'm not saying I have. I'm just saying some
I
people
still,
do.
I still reach around and turn on the light before I walk into every room.
Yeah, you can do that. but it did feel like, wow, we're really tapping into a truth about kids that can make more depth to this film beyond just the appeal of wouldn't it be cool to see a monster that isn't as scary as he looks.
And early on we had an idea that maybe that we could get actual kids to design the film, you know, in some way, that we would base the designs on kids' drawings. We didn't go that far, but we did pull from our own childhood and imagine what we thought monsters were like. One of the real balances was finding that line between scary and appealing. And I think, you know, our rule here is always, you're going to ask people to spend an hour and a half with these characters. And they better be really interesting and appealing, you know, interesting and people that you want to spend time with. I mean, can you imagine, it's like having a long dinner with somebody that you can't stand. I mean, it gets painful. So we try our hardest to make them as appealing as possible, but still remain true to the idea that they are monsters. One of the things, an example of kind of that balance is Mike has these sharp, pointy teeth, but as opposed to, we didn't make them that sharp and pointy. We kind of rounded them off and made them a little wider so that they're just more appealing, but still remain true to the idea that he's a monster.
One of the interesting things about this movie is that it's in a weird way the same ingredients that we've always had on the other films, but just slightly different proportions or uses of them. Because the same people have been working on all these films from the get-go. And when we first did Toy Story, John and Joe and Pete and I and Lee, we all kind of realized it's sort of that lucky chemistry that comes with a great band. And there's just something that happens when we combine all our talents and efforts together and our focus. And it's been really exciting to sort of shake it up and now let Pete run with an idea he had and direct something. But all of us get to play a role. I got to come in as a writer. John got to be executive producer. Lee got to come in as a co-director. And everybody still got to sort of have their hands in the project, but sort of in slightly different roles and in different amounts. And it's been really exciting to see that, because I think it's one of the things that keeps it fresh. We're not feeling like we're just retreading doing the same old thing.
I think the mysterious thing is a lot of people associate that hands all over stuff with getting worse,
right,
you know?
Right.
And somehow, I don't even, John, maybe you can talk about how it gets better. I have no idea how, but it's like somehow we're able to figure out, we're able to pick out the good ideas and the intentions behind those so that we're not just blindly doing suggestions of people's. We're getting to the heart of the problem, you know? Well, one of the things is that we set up at Pixar a working environment that is, it doesn't matter whose idea it is, truly the best idea is the one that we all automatically, oh, that's it, right? But also, you can't have ownership of an individual idea, because you'll come up with an idea, then people take and go, oh, yeah, and what if you did this? And then Andrew would even finish his sentence and go, and plus that, and then I would plus that, and then Joe, and all this. So by the time you're done, it is everybody's idea.
It really is like a band. It's like somebody started a riff, and then everybody jammed, and then you got this song out of it. And
you know,
it's always been that way.
You know, each and every person who works on these films with us, I mean, these are people who are just at the top of their form. They're the most creative, talented, artistic people you can imagine. And, you know, I personally feel so fortunate to show up at work every day knowing that I get to work with them. I just feel lucky that I get to be surrounded by these amazing people.
Everybody at every stage is just the best in the world that we know of. You know, the best story guys, the best shader, the best painters, the best modelers. Everything comes together in this really great way where at every stage the film gets better and better. It never just goes along the pipeline. It gets better. And it's really exciting.
And that comes down from the top. I mean, John Lasseter has fostered this kind of collaborative spirit here at the company, and we have him to thank for the great environment that we get to work in.
So thanks a lot for listening to the commentary. We had a lot of fun recounting all this stuff. It's been a long process. This film's taken a long time, and there are a lot of stories to tell about it.
So hopefully you found it interesting, and you know, we look forward to talking to you again someday on another film.
It'd be great.
Nice.
What?
Oh,
what? Is it over?
Oh my gosh! Why didn't you tell us it was over?
That must be just us two guys talking the whole time.
Jeez. Oh my God! Look at there's the castle already.
It's over.
Oh, gotta say goodbye. It was really great watching some of this with you.
Right. Well, it was good.
This is Andrew. Bye.
This is John Lasseter saying goodbye.
Quick before the Luxor lamp goes out. Come on.
Okay.
Come on.
All right. All right.
Say goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed it. We're really happy to make Monsters Incorporated.
Computers are really cool.
Yeah.